I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. For more than 3 weeks, Baltimore City government computers have been seized by an aggressive hack that has knocked out phone lines, shut down emails, and delayed real estate sales. Baltimore is the latest U.S. city to be hit by a ransomware cyber attack. It joins corporations like FedEx and millions of people who awake one day to find their data suddenly held hostage. And the cost is staggering. Hacking is a lucrative industry worth billions of dollars. Today, a conversation about the origins of the ransomware that has crippled Baltimore's computer system and what can be done to fix it with Scott Shane of the New York Times and Avi Rubin, a cybersecurity expert from Johns Hopkins University. Plus, analysis of Robert Mueller's just completed remarks on the Russia probe. That's coming up when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, a conversation about the origins of the ransomware virus that has incapacitated the computer system in Baltimore City. But before we get to that, about an hour ago, Robert Mueller made his first public remarks about the Russia probe since submitting his report to Attorney General William Barr on March 22nd. He spoke at the Justice Department this morning for less than 10 minutes. He did not take questions from reporters. Joining me now, a reporter who has been covering the Russia probe for the last 3 years. Scott Shane has been part of teams at the New York Times that have won a Pulitzer Prize on two occasions. He's also the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, which was published in 2015. Scott, welcome back, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So you have been on this story a long time. When you heard Mr. Mueller's remarks this morning, what struck you?
I guess what struck me is it was exactly what I expected from Mueller. He's not a creature of the limelight. And, you know, I could imagine that the last thing he wanted to do was to go to Congress and, endure hours of very, very politicized back and forth from the Democrats and the Republicans. So he basically said, I wrote my report, you know, read the report, and I'm out of here. Not surprising, but he did sort of reemphasize a number of crucial points that the report makes, the first being that, as President Trump often emphasizes, there was, as Mr. Mueller said, insufficient evidence to charge a broad conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia, that he clearly found evidence of obstruction of justice on the president's part, but chose not to make a decision about charging him or not charging him because of a Justice Department policy that says you cannot charge, you cannot indict a sitting president. And so once again, he reiterated that he could not absolve him of obstruction of justice, but chose not to charge him because of that policy. And, you know, also, you know, if you're reading between the lines, said it was important to gather the evidence in a timely manner. The way some people have interpreted that is when President Trump leaves office, you know, he will no longer have that protection and could be charged. The final point was, and this was somewhat subtle, but he pointed out that the Constitution has other means to punish a president, to examine a president, and that is to say impeachment. He didn't use the impeachment word, but he was clearly sort of saying to Congress, the ball's in your court.
That's interesting that you say that you interpreted his remarks as perhaps indicating, again, between the lines, that after Mr. Trump is out of office, he could be subject to a criminal indictment, because it seemed to me that he put that to rest. That's interesting, because he did say not only can you not indict a sitting president, mm-hmm. according to this DOJ policy, but he also called it unconstitutional to do mm-hmm. so. But he said that you can't even have a sealed indictment mm-hmm. That may be opened at a later date after presumably the subject is out of office.
Mm-hmm. But there, for those who want to delve into the footnotes of the, 400 and something pages of the Mueller report, you can find some footnotes that specifically talk about essentially preserving a record of evidence for the time when the president will not be a sitting president who has this particular protection, but will be, just as indictable as the rest of us. And, you know, most legal scholars don't seem to think that will happen. But it's interesting that, you know, sort of playing very meticulously by the rules here, he's pointing out that the president will leave office at some point and no longer have that protection, and in theory could be charged with a crime.
He said one thing that surprised me, at least, and probably doesn't surprise you because you know about this stuff much in much greater detail than I do, but Mr. Mueller said that Attorney General Barr determined that it was appropriate to release the report in a redacted form, but that Mueller himself had suggested releasing even less of it, that he at one point was in favor of these executive summaries that he had prepared for each of the sections.
Yeah, it wasn't totally clear to me that he was saying he'd oppose the release of the full report. He seemed to express gratitude to Barr for releasing the report, but you're right. I mean, he was essentially deferring to the AG, the Attorney General, because that's the Attorney General's job, is to decide what part of the report is releasable. And you know, I think he also probably recognized that if Barr had withheld large portions, you know, a large percentage of the report, that would have set off a political firestorm, which would certainly have, you know, engulfed Mueller. We do know from previous reporting that Mueller was unhappy with Barr's summaries, and that some of his troops, the prosecutors working under him, felt that Barr had, to some degree, misrepresented the contents of the report. But that's all, at this point, sort of water under the bridge.
It is water under the bridge, but I wonder if that fact, that there seemed to be people in Mr. Mueller's office, at least, if not Mr. Mueller himself, who were dissatisfied with Mr. Barr's summary and the length of time between the summary and the release of the redacted report. I mean, remember just the timeline here. On the 22nd of March, Mr. Mueller submitted his report to Attorney General Barr. 2 days later, that was a Friday, 2 days later on Sunday, Mr. Barr sent this letter, a brief letter to Congress summarizing what was in the report. There seems to be a letter just 3 days after that from Mr. Mueller or his office, well, it was signed by Mr. Mueller, questioning some of Barr's summary, I mean, seeming to contest that. That we didn't find out about that letter for almost a month later, to the 1st of May, but it was between the 24th of March and the 18th of April. It was a long time between Barr's summary letter and the time we actually saw the 400-plus page report. So by that time, there was a perception on at least part of the public that the report exonerated the president.
Yes, to quote the president himself, total exoneration. And you can imagine a somewhat different, obviously the reaction to the report would be very polarized in any case, but you can imagine a slightly different reaction overall had the public seen the report first thing, without any summary, without any press conference from Barr, if they'd just seen the raw report from the word go.
For the president and his supporters, he repeats no collusion, no obstruction. Do you think Mr. Mueller's statement today backs that up to any degree?
I mean, the president is a politician, and Mueller's a very careful prosecutor in this case, and he didn't say no collusion. He said insufficient evidence to charge a broader conspiracy, I believe were his words.
And that's the Russia part.
That's the collusion
Volume one,
part,
right.
Exactly. And then on obstruction, he certainly didn't say no obstruction. I mean, I think if you read the report, there was plenty of obstruction, but he did not have to, you know, Mueller essentially opted out of making the judgment himself as to whether he would have charged the president if Justice Department policy allowed it. And then Barr stepped in, the Attorney General stepped in and said, well, guess what? I'm the Attorney General, and I'm deciding there will not be charges, that this does not rise to the level of a chargeable crime.
Scott Chain is a reporter for the New York Times. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're starting our program today discussing Robert Mueller's remarks, which he made at the Justice Department about an hour and 15 minutes ago. He spoke for less than 10 minutes. He did not take questions from reporters, and he made it quite clear that he said right at the beginning of his remarks that it was important that the office's written work speak for itself. He said he had no intention whatsoever of testifying before Congress, that the written word that he and his colleagues in the special counsel's office published last March will be the final word. We have a tweet from Senator Cummings, Elijah Cummings, who chairs the House Oversight Committee. He says, special counsel Mueller's statement today confirms both the evidence of obstruction by the president and the critical role of Congress under the Constitution going forward. We have a tweet from Senator Kamala Harris, who's one of the Democratic nominees for or running in the Democratic primary for president. She says, what Robert Mueller basically did was return an impeachment referral. Now it's up to Congress to hold this president accountable. We need to start impeachment proceedings. It's our constitutional obligation. That's all we're going to talk about, the Mueller report today. We're going to move on to the other topic du jour, the topic that we had immediately or originally planned to talk about for the entire hour. We, of course, will have more conversation about the Mueller report and Mr. Mueller's statement on other programs here on Midday. But on May 7th, a ransomware virus shut down the computer system of much of Baltimore City, and many city agencies and officials were unable to send or receive emails or voicemails. Websites remained functional, but city employees have only gradually been able to restore ways in which the public can communicate with them. The fix for this malicious malware will take a long time, and it's going to cost a lot of money. City Council President Brandon Scott has asked Governor Larry Hogan to request an emergency declaration from the federal government to assist in the slow process of restoring the system so bills can be paid and databases accessed, documents can be produced, and the city's business can be accomplished. So what does the attack mean for the city and for other public entities, private corporations, and individuals? So Scott Shane of the New York Times is the co-author with Nicole Perlroth of a story last week that traces the origins of the malware to the National Security Agency, of all places. So Scott, this piece talks about something called Eternal Blue, and this was something evidently developed at the NSA, and then it's become part of the public domain for the last couple of years. So start us from the top. What is Eternal Blue, and what does it do?
Well, let me go back even farther to National Security Agency, as people around here for the most part know, I think, at this point, is the big eavesdropping, you know, sort of electronic intercept agency that's been around since 1952 and is located right down the road from Baltimore at Fort Meade. And, you know, in this day and age, one of their jobs in collecting intelligence is not just to eavesdrop on phone calls or intercept emails, but to actually go out and break into foreign computer networks and try to collect documents and communications in that manner. And the way they do that is they go out and look for vulnerabilities in widely used software, such as Windows. And when they find, or in some cases buy, one of these vulnerabilities, they make a decision as to whether they should alert the software company saying, hey, there's a hole in your security, you better fix it. Or if they want to hang on to it and use it for a period of time to break into foreign networks before it becomes widely known, use it as a tool of espionage, in other words. So they stockpile these hacking tools, and Eternal Blue was one of those, and it did target versions of Windows software. And according, this is all classified, but according to what we were able to learn, for at least 5 years, maybe a little longer, Eternal Blue was used very successfully to break into foreign computer networks, into terrorist organizations' computers, and to collect intelligence. But then something happened that people have often feared might happen in this case when you have an agency hanging on to all these vulnerabilities. And so in 2016, a still mysterious, still unidentified group calling itself the Shadow Brokers, somehow, either through hacking or maybe with a disgruntled insider, got a hold of a large collection of these hacking tools, first tried to auction them off on the web, and then ultimately just dumped them in April of 2017 for anybody to grab. And so state intelligence agencies from other countries, criminals, anybody who wants to grab one of these tools can now try to put it to work, and that's what's happened, including with Eternal Blue.
So we turn now to Avi Rubin, who is a computer science professor at Johns Hopkins University and a cybersecurity expert who joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we take a little break, can you just explain briefly for us what the relationship between this product that Scott's talking about, Eternal Blue, is to Robinhood, which is the malware that we're told infected the Baltimore City computers and has affected city computers in other areas as well. There are these various different kinds of ransomware, WannaCry, and Robinhood seems to be the one that's infected our local government. How does Eternal Blue work within or in concert with Robinhood?
Sure. So as you said, Robinhood is the malware that affected Baltimore City. And we've seen other variants and very high-profile attacks like WannaCry that you mentioned. And what these do is they exploit particular vulnerabilities in the target systems. And so Eternal Blue is a weapon in the arsenal now of any malicious party that wants to attack a certain organization. And what they can do is layer their specific attack around Eternal Blue, use that as the way of getting in and penetrating the system. And then once they've gotten in, they can do what they want, which is in this case to encrypt all the files on there and demand a ransom that has to be paid in order to get them back. But Eternal Blue, without that, the attack wouldn't have been possible because the sophisticated engineers who designed it and built it performed something that's a very high skill that your average hacker wouldn't be able to do. But your average hacker, given a tool like that at their disposal, can then create all sorts of malware that can actually be used to perform various attacks successfully.
Yeah, so Robinhood wouldn't have been able to work without the sort of fundament of Eternal Blue.
It relied on that underlying technology.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how this came to be in the public domain, the sort of, the timeline, if you will, about how it came out, and then what we can do, because it's not just city governments that are affected, it's individuals. There's one estimate that there's some 2 million computers that are still infected with this kind of ransomware. So we'll talk about that with Scott Shane. He covers national security for the New York Times. His article with Nicole Perlroth was posted last week. It's called In Baltimore and Beyond, A Stolen NSA Tool Wreaks Havoc. Avi Rubin is here as well. He's a cybersecurity expert from Johns Hopkins University. And we'll take your calls and comments, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday WYPR, assuming your computer is safe. And you can also join our conversation when we come back from this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Baltimore City's new health commissioner, Dr. Leticia Drassa. She took office about 2 months ago, and we'll talk about her priorities for the health department. Plus, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, will review the latest show at the Annapolis Shakespeare Company. It's called the... It's a little musical you may have heard. I've actually heard of it, which is very unusual when we talk about theater stuff. It's called Oliver. I think our director and engineer, Luke Spicknall, appeared in several thousand performances of Oliver as a third grader. Isn't that right, Luke? Yep, that's where you want some more. More gruel, sir. That's it. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow. So Leticia Drassa, our new health commissioner, and J. Wynn Russick. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Scott Shane of the New York Times. He's the co-author of a story for the Times about the origins of the ransomware virus that has crippled the city of Baltimore and other systems around the country, as well as Avi Rubin. He's a professor of computer science at Johns Hopkins and an expert in cybersecurity. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. So, Scott, it's been estimated, or you report in your piece in the Times, that this leak, if you will, or this dissemination of Eternal Blue by this group called Shadow Brokers is more damaging than the better-known leak back in 2013 from Edward Snowden. At the time, that was just this amazing breach. But this is actually even more damaging because the extent of how this has been used in the way that Avi Rubin was just talking about before the break is really enormous.
Yeah, so it's sort of Snowden released information sort of about cyber weapons, but not the cyber weapons themselves. This was the Shadow Brokers released the actual cyber weapons, so to speak, or the malware or exploits, whatever you want to call them. And so they were picked up in 2017 by what turned out to be North Korean intelligence used for a very expensive attack called WannaCry, and then by Russian intelligence, which used it for something called NotPetya, extremely expensive. It cost companies like FedEx and Merck and Maersk hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, the total cost of this thing is in the billions around the world, and you know, it's still trailing off, and now we see these attacks on American cities, among other places.
And Avi Rubin, the attack here in Baltimore, it's called ransomware because that's what they do. As you mentioned, they encrypt all of the data so you don't have any access to the stuff on your computer or on the network, and they say, if you pay us this ransom, we'll unlock it and we'll give it to you. In general, do a lot of people pay the ransom, and how does that work out?
I know for a fact that there are a lot of companies that secretly pay the ransom, and especially when there's no public knowledge that they've been hit by ransomware, they feel it's easier for them to pay this and hopefully get their data than not to. But as soon as something becomes public, I think it's a different story. Personally, I believe it's a mistake to pay the ransomware. I think you're providing fuel for this illegal activity, and you're giving them a reason and an incentive to make these types of attacks, and you have no guarantee that you're going to get your data anyway. You know, they could pay the $100,000 or so that Bitcoin is worth right now, and the response could be, actually pay us another $300,000 or we're not going to give you anything. And the other thing to remember is it's not just that the data has been encrypted. Being able to decrypt that data would be very useful because there's very valuable information in those databases. But a lot of these computers have been really messed up because the ransomware software, the malware itself that's Robinhood, it turns off a lot of system services. It wreaks havoc on the computer. And so it's not enough just to get the data back. They wouldn't be able to get their systems up and running right away, even if they paid it.
And Scott Chain, why was the city of Baltimore targeted, or perhaps I should say, was the city of Baltimore targeted, and are other cities and municipalities, we hear about this kind of thing happening in Atlanta, we hear about it happening in cities from, as you say in your piece, you know, from Pennsylvania to Texas. Baltimore is by no means unique in this regard. Are cities and municipal governments particularly susceptible to this kind of thing?
Well, I think they are particularly susceptible because, you know, they struggle with budget issues. They have far-flung networks, and so they don't have the kind of computer security that you might wish they had. And so in this particular case, we don't know all the places Eternal Blue was used, but we did confirm that it was used in Allentown, Pennsylvania last year, and in San Antonio, Texas, in somewhat similar, different software, but malware packages, but similar circumstances. You know, Avi would probably have a more informed opinion, but my impression is that the criminal hackers who are doing this are sort of, throwing their malware out into the world using various means, phishing attacks and other things, and where they find, so to speak, an open door, they walk through. So that I don't think anyone sat down and said, geez, how about Baltimore, Maryland? Probably it was more scattershot than that, and they found a kind of vulnerable system in Baltimore. Would you say that's true, Avi?
Yeah, definitely. So In the early days of ransomware, the place where we saw it the most was in hospitals and medical IT systems. And the reasoning, I think, behind
that— It brought down the entire national health system in Great Britain.
That's right. Yeah, right. And the reason I think that they made a really good target was several. One is that medical information is extremely valuable, and the holders of that information, in particular facing a life-threatening situation, would be highly motivated to pay the ransom. But the health IT establishment, in particular, I'm familiar with Johns Hopkins, they got smart. They figured out how to deal with ransomware and became a much softer target because they had really good backups and they had very good systems that had been patched and up to date. And so the attackers look for the next juicy target. And so one rung below the healthcare, obviously they figured out, is municipalities because of their financial constraints and the impact that a ransomware attack can have on a city. Think about how many people were affected when they were unable to contact their city government, when the database of real estate liens was unavailable. And so the attackers are looking for someone that's going to pay. And by attacking someone who's going to feel the maximum pain when this ransomware attack happens, I think it was pretty clear that these city municipalities were a juicy target for them.
Yeah, and of course, when we talk about the cost to the city of Baltimore, Andre Davis, the city solicitor, was on the show last week. And at that juncture, the only way the city of Baltimore could receive revenue was paper checks. You couldn't pay online. You couldn't pay with a credit card. So there's all these payments that can't be made because people are not set up to write paper checks. And as well, it was difficult for the city to pay the vendors that it owes money to. So the economy, the way this spreads through the city economy, because the city has services that it contracts with, you know, thousands of people, the city couldn't pay them. It was very difficult to have money move back and forth. And you mentioned the real estate sales, which basically came to a halt for a few days until they figured out a paper way of doing it. Avi Rubin is a cybersecurity expert at Johns Hopkins University. Scott Shane is an expert in all sorts of things, and he's a reporter for the New York Times. We're talking about the ransomware attack that's hit the city of Baltimore here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones to John in Timonium. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I want to know, and I'm sure this is really naive, but I would like to know more about why it is so hard to track back to the physical location of hackers.
All right. That's a good question, John. So you mentioned Bitcoin. This is the literally the coin of the realm of people. This is how they pay in these instances. If you're going to send somebody some money somewhere, you can't figure out exactly who they are or where they are still.
Right. Tracking people in computer networks is very different from tracking criminals in the physical world. In the physical world, someone has to actually go somewhere to launch an attack. But today, you can attack from anywhere in the world that's connected to the internet. And there are various ways for you to mask your location. There are things called internet relays, which will act as an intermediary forwarding all of the attacker's internet traffic to a particular location. And in fact, you can bounce your traffic through multiple relays so that when it arrives at the target destination, all you see is the last relay in the path. And even then, you just see the IP address. And the IP address could be something that the service provider provided to that location. And every day, it could give a different IP address to that location. And so the issue with online tracking of people is that you could take a device and be completely anonymous. You go to a cyber cafe in Eastern Europe, and by the time that attack traffic reaches the victim, it has gone through 20 different places and 15 different countries, and there's no way to connect it to the origin in that cyber cafe.
And Scott, the policy to hold on to this device that can be used for espionage, as you mentioned. So let me make sure I'm clear. The NSA held on to this and didn't notify Microsoft for how long?
For at least 5 years is what we've been told. And that's, you know, that's not unusual. It's hotly debated inside the government, outside the government. But there's something called, with the awkward title of the Vulnerabilities Equities Process, that is just basically a bunch of people from various agencies who get together under the auspices of the White House. And the way I understand it is NSA says, geez, you know, we found this this hole, this vulnerability in Windows. We'd love to use it for spying. What's everyone think? And sometimes the decision will be made, no, you know what, you better tell Microsoft about that. In other cases, they'll say, okay, go and run with it for a while. But, you know, it's all cloaked in secrecy. And, you know, one of the things that makes this difficult, I think, for policymaking is that NSA has, for example, never publicly acknowledged that it lost all these hacking tools in 2017 to the shadow brokers. And when I called NSA on Friday about this story, as usual, they said no comment. They and indeed pointed out that they have never commented on the notion that the shadow brokers got a hold of their tools, even though that's widely known in the world. And, you know, we've discussed it with many former NSA employees who were involved in various ways. So it's not secret, but NSA continues to treat it as secret.
And so, Avi, We talk about municipal entities having outdated computer systems, old software, old physical computers. In terms of the preparedness of the city of Baltimore for an event like this, we have an email from our friend Klaus Philipson who says, do we know if the city has a full set of backup data that are not blocked by the encryption? And if so, what needs to be done before putting them back on the server? Do you know anything about that, whether or not the city does have a backup that, you know, is clean data, it's unencrypted, that they could reload to the computers at some point?
My understanding, and this is just from public news reports, I don't have any firsthand knowledge about their backup systems, but my understanding is that they did not have adequate backups of a lot of the databases. And one thing to consider is that many of these systems are live systems, meaning a lot of transactions are happening and the databases are updating all the time. And so even if they have a weekly backup, they're going to have at least, you know, some amount of time between when they did the backup and when transactions happened that should be completely lost. I do think that going forward, they need to look at cloud-based systems, and there are a lot of well-known backup techniques that can render ransomware pretty much meaningless, although the malware attack that goes along with the ransomware can set you back a few days, but you won't have this wholesale loss of all of this valuable data if you do proper backups.
But a cloud-based backup system, it does protect you, it insulates you somewhat from a ransomware attack?
You know, it's an arms race. There are cloud-based solutions that can provide protection against the currently known ransomware attacks, but you can also envision more sophisticated ransomware attacks that would attack the cloud-based backup system as well. I think that if you take the best cloud-based backup systems we have today, that would provide adequate protection against the known attacks today.
Yeah, but that's today.
Right.
Operative word there is today. And Scott Shane, the City Council, President Brandon Scott, has sent a letter to Governor Hogan asking him to request federal assistance in this matter, declaring basically a FEMA emergency, is the same akin to a national or a natural disaster, a hurricane or a tornado or something. And I wonder, I mean, the fact that it's the federal government, the National Security Agency, that is the source of this thing, at least in some part, does that give grist to the argument of municipalities like Baltimore or the others that you mentioned, San Antonio, for federal disaster relief? Because this, in a way, sort of started with the feds to begin with.
Well, I don't know from a legal point of view whether you could call this the equivalent of a natural disaster. In fact, of course, it's a human-caused disaster and not a natural disaster. But, Baltimore's getting creative in terms of who's going to pay the presumably very large bill for this thing. And with NSA right down the road and a lot of NSA employees living in and around Baltimore, it's logical for them to look in that direction. I think one reason NSA has been so secretive about this stuff is the last thing they want is for, say, FedEx or Merck, which lost hundreds of millions of dollars to an attack using their exploit, or Baltimore City on a smaller scale, to come knocking at their door saying, hey, how about some, reparations here? It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. So, members of Congress from Maryland weighed in over the weekend saying, they had some questions for NSA.
Yeah, Dutch Rubersberger has asked for a briefing from NSA. And Avi Rubin, before we go to a break, there are those who point to the fact that Microsoft did issue a patch to address this potential problem back in 2017. And it seems that most, if not all, computers in the city of Baltimore didn't have the patch installed. So in that way, is it on the folks running the IT for the city of Baltimore?
I think the people running the IT for the city do bear some responsibility, because patching is one of the easier and low-cost ways of keeping your system secure. But I'll say that in my consulting business, I find very often that even well-funded, sophisticated clients don't do the patching, either just because they're lazy or, it's kind of inexplicable because it's something easy to do, but they just don't get around to it. And I hope they will, now that they've seen what can happen when you don't.
Avi Rubin teaches computer science at Johns Hopkins University. Scott Shane covers national security for the New York Times. We're talking about the ransomware that has afflicted computers throughout the city of Baltimore, the government down there at City Hall, and which could afflict computers in homes and businesses throughout the land. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. We will be right back.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about hacks, cyber threats, and the recent ransomware attack that has seized Baltimore City government computer networks. Towns from Pennsylvania to Texas, including major cities like Atlanta, have suffered the same fate, as has the British healthcare system and huge companies like FedEx and Merck. Attackers lock up the systems and demand a ransom to unlock them. Baltimore officials have refused to pay a ransom. They are rebuilding the network one computer at a time. The Baltimore Brew and others reported last week that a protective fix for this problem was made available by Microsoft 2 years ago, but it apparently wasn't installed on most city computers. Scott Shane wrote about the origins of this ransomware for the New York Times. Avi Rubin is a cybersecurity expert on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. They join me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, Scott Shane, in terms of understanding whether most of the actors in events like what's happened here in Baltimore are either individual actors or state actors. You mentioned North Korea, Russia, they've all been implicated in various other kinds of hacks. Does the NSA, does the United States government have a handle on whether a lot of this, most of this, some of this is coming from state actors or individuals?
You know, I'll be interested to hear what Avi says about this, but from what I know, as Avi already said, it's a little bit difficult sometimes to track a hack back to the perpetrator, and so sometimes it's very difficult to tell, and sometimes it's only after weeks or months of sort of study and analysis that you figure out that the Russian GRU, Military Intelligence Agency, was behind this, or just some guy, and sometimes you've had state agencies doing things to earn money the same way a criminal hacker might do. So it's very tricky. Certainly my impression would be that the likely perp in the case of Baltimore would be a criminal hacker or a criminal hacking group and not a state. But this stuff is, one of the big problems with it is it's done largely anonymously.
Yeah, and Avi, for individual computer users, for the folks who have their laptops open at this very moment or in their house or even their office, what are the basic things that folks should be aware of to avoid becoming a victim of this kind of thing?
It's very hard in this day and age right now to secure a Windows machine as an individual user. It helps if you're part of an enterprise that's got a firewall and it's got an IT support. The thing that you should do is turn off all your unwanted services. Now, I can tell a computer scientist to do that and they know what I mean. My wife would not know exactly how to do that, so she'd call me in to do it. But there are ways of turning off services on a computer that aren't being used.
What kind of services are we talking about?
These are the ports that are on the computer. So, for example, there's a Microsoft service called SMB, which is a service message block, and that runs on a particular port. And so if you're a computer administrator, you can turn off that port, and no traffic will come to that port. And there are other common sense things that you should know about. Don't open attachments that come from email addresses that you don't recognize, although that advice is limited because a lot of the hackers will forge an email from an email address you do recognize and have the malicious link in there. So it's very difficult. But I'd like to address the point about is this a state actor or an individual. One interesting thing to note is that sometimes in the malware, the analysts will find a signature or a fingerprint, so to speak, of the attacker, because just like when you write English text by hand, somebody can recognize that that's your handwriting. There are certain things, trademarks of somebody's programming style, and certain well-known hackers are actually known to the intelligence communities. And so they look for particular signatures in the code. There's a twist to this, which is there have already been documented cases of people borrowing code from other hackers in order to get that signature and blame those other hackers for a particular malware. And so this is a game, a forensics game that's played, and very often big high-profile attacks happen and we end up having no idea ever who did it.
It's a hard thing to know, Scott, but in your reporting, do you have any sense of how the NSA has responded to their leak? I mean, when this thing became part of the public domain, what does the NSA then do? Because just like when the Snowden material became available, there was all sorts of concern about the physical safety of operatives who were working around the world. The methods in which people were conducting espionage were revealed, along with specific names of people and locations of people. I'm sure that a whole bunch of methodology was revealed when this exploit was published online. So other people, other governments can look and say, okay, here's what the USA is doing. We're now figuring out how they're approaching this. I mean, how did they recover from something like that?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I know just from talking to people who were inside the place at the time that this, you know, hit the NSA like a ton of bricks. And the FBI and NSA have carried out now for going on 3 years a very large, serious investigation to identify the so-called shadow brokers. For a while, the leading theory was it might be Russian intelligence. More recently, I'm hearing that they think there might have been an insider involved. But but as far as we can tell, they have not actually identified the shadow brokers. In the meantime, though, you're absolutely right that other countries could look back even at the malware they had been that had been used to steal their secrets and say, aha, you know, that wasn't the Germans, it wasn't the Russians, that was the Americans. So there's a way of sort of going back and using the fingerprint that you knew was coming, now you know was coming from NSA, to undo, to sort of figure out some of that. Other agencies knew that they, you know, foreign agencies could pick up these tools, use them against third parties or third countries, and that country might say, hey, this is the U.S. So they could be used for so-called false flags in that case to throw the scent off of the perpetrator.
And Avi, is there any reason to believe that the Windows system, Microsoft's system, is any more vulnerable than the Apple system, for example, the OIS system?
Only in the sense that Windows is the most widely used system, and so it represents the biggest target. But there have been just as many exploits against Apple. In the early days of Microsoft, you could get a room full of computer security experts to laugh by just saying the word Windows. They were known for having so many vulnerabilities and being such an easy target. And then there was the famous Bill Gates memo where Bill Gates said that Microsoft was going to take security very seriously, and they came up with mechanisms for analyzing each other's code before it was released. And Microsoft does a very good job with security now, but when you write millions of lines of code, it doesn't matter what steps you take or how good you are, there are going to be vulnerabilities. And that's true of every single platform, every single phone platform, every single desktop, laptop platform that there is.
Yeah, Scott Shane, does the government have better hackers than these individual companies? Because it's interesting that here NSA discovers this vulnerability in Microsoft, decides not to tell them about it for 5 years. But I would assume there are people at Microsoft whose job it is to try to hack into the stuff that they've created just to make sure that it's not vulnerable. I mean, there's kind of an arms race that way, too, the private
Absolutely.
Enterprise versus the government.
Well, and NSA spends a whole lot of your money on this project. And there's actually a sort of gray market or black market for invulnerabilities. And you can buy the sort of very serious vulnerabilities known as 0 days out on the market, or you can discover them. And NSA has a lot of people working on that problem. It is, you know, I detect a certain amount of hostility or resentment between, you know, say Microsoft and NSA, because the last thing Microsoft needs is, you know, people discovering holes in their products. And NSA needs to spy. So, you know, they have they have different purposes, and they're somewhat at cross purposes.
And Avi, the estimates of the number of computers that are still infected, Ars Technica had a piece that said as many as 1.7 million internet-connected endpoints are still vulnerable. And it's not just folks who are connected to the internet, but people who happen to be connected to infected servers. So, for example, Amazon has a big business being the server for all sorts of companies and individuals. If somebody is able to get into an Amazon system or any of these other large server things, that could would a patch or an update on an individual computer protect against that?
So one of the most vulnerable things that you can have is an attack that doesn't do anything right away. You could have vulnerable ports and you get the malware to spread on the computers without showing any signs that it's there. If you think about an analogy in the physical world to a virus that kills you within 10 seconds of getting infected is not going to be a big risk to society because the people that get infected will die and they won't spread the disease. But if you have a virus that lies dormant for a year before you get sick, that's going to spread to all of the people, and then all of a sudden everybody will get very sick. And the same is true of computer systems. If you have a virus that doesn't delete any files or show itself for a while, it will spread like crazy through computer systems because it won't be patched and people won't know that they're infected. And some of the Eternal Blue systems or malware that was developed using Eternal Blue didn't activate right away. And so it spread widely. And that's why we can have a lot of infected systems out there that don't know they're infected.
And Scott Shane, in terms of America's vulnerability versus other places in the world, is Europe more experienced, less experienced in this regard? Asia, the African continent, are there other places that have done a better or worse job than we are doing currently?
I'm not sure there's a huge difference, say, between Europe and the U.S., but the more connected a country is, the more dependent on computers and computer networks, the more vulnerable they're going to be sort of by definition. So in that sense, the U.S. is a very big target. You know, a very well-connected, very rich country is going to be essentially the mother load for any hackers trying to get rich.
And Avi, this is a big business. We did a show a week or so ago about robocalls. There were 5 billion robocalls in the month of March alone on our cell phones and our landlines. And the reason there's so many is that 3 to 5% of people respond to them. So they're able to extract money from 3 to 5%. So this is clearly a profitable industry because if you have a 1% return on investment, if you've got 5 billion things out there, you're going to make some money.
Right. The economics are not in our favor because the cost to launch an attack is very, very small. And if you get even a very small percentage of hits, so you have an almost no-cost attack and you have some monetary return, then it's worth it to do it.
When we talk about patches, that is synonymous with upgrades. When you get a little notice in your Windows system that says, you know, upgrades are available or they're done automatically, that's the thing that installs these patches, right?
That's right. A patch is just taking some code and replacing code that you have in your system with it. And so we can call them upgrades, updates, patches. We're talking about the same thing.
And commercially available antivirus programs, you know, WebRoot and Symantec and Norton and those kinds of things, are they generally effective against these things, assuming the upgrades on individual computers are installed?
So I use the term arms race, and we use that term all the time. The antivirus software is very effective against malware that's known. Against the 0 days that Scott mentioned, it can't do anything because you can't build a defense into your system for an attack that no one's ever seen before.
On that cheery note, we're going to have to leave it because we've run out of time and maybe we've run out of hope, too. Scott Shane from the New York Times and Avi Rubin from Johns Hopkins University, very much appreciate you guys being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday Health Watch with the new Baltimore City Health Commissioner, Dr. Letitia Girasa. Plus, Jaywin Russick reviews Oliver at the Annapolis Shakespeare Company, and I hope you can join us as well. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults this summer. The Baltimore Chef Shop will be offering classes in kitchen technique every Tuesday night starting in July. There's more information on the web at baltimorechefshop.com, and gift certificates are available. Here and Now is up next after the NPR news break at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.